Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. North and South Korea met late into the night in an emergency round of high-level talks aimed at ending the tense standoff that has brought the two rivals to the brink of war. The talks got underway this morning and continued as midnight approached, according to Seoul's unification ministry. South Korean President Park Geun-hye's national security advisor met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's aide at the request of Pyongyang. Passengers who survived a terror attack on a train traveling between Amsterdam and Paris are paying tribute to the heroism of three Americans, two servicemen and a student who led the charge to overwhelm the attacker. Authorities in Spain have now identified the gunman as a 26-year-old radical Islamist who spent time in Syria during the past year. French Interior Minister Bernard Cazeneuve says he was under investigation for links to militant Islam. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
France has been on high alert since January's terrorist attacks in Paris. And in June, extremist Yassine Sali decapitated a man near the French city of Lyon.
Si l'identité qu'il déclare,
if his tentative identity is confirmed, the French minister said the gunman may be a 26-year-old Moroccan who lived in Spain last year before moving to Belgium. Cazeneuve said Spanish authorities had flagged him to their French counterparts because he belonged to a radical Islamist movement. French and U.S. authorities have hailed the American passengers who tackled and subdued the gunman who was carrying several weapons, including a Kalashnikov assault rifle. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
U.S. officials say the number two leader of the Islamic State group known as Haji Mutaz was killed in a drone strike near the Iraqi city of Mosul on August 18th. The U.S. reported his death late last year but was incorrect. This is VOA News. Meantime, the U.S. military says initial field tests show traces of a chemical agent on mortar rounds used by Islamic State militants to attack Kurdish forces in Iraq have been found. U.S. Brigadier General Kevin Kilia, head of military operations against the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria, said field tests show the presence of what is known as sulfur mustard, a class one chemical on fragments of the bombs used in an attack 11 days ago. The general asked reporters not to speculate on the origins of the chemical until formal tests are complete. Thai authorities are reviewing newly discovered security camera footage in their investigation of last week's deadly bomb blast at a Bangkok shrine. The surveillance video is related to a separate attack that occurred hours later and several kilometers away from the original shrine blast. The footage shows a man in a blue shirt placing a bag on a footbridge, kicking it into the water, and later an explosion occurring. Officials have not been yet able to determine if the two incidents were related but are seeking the man in the blue shirt for questioning. The leading Republican candidate for U.S. President, Donald Trump, held a rally in the state of Alabama on Friday, attended by thousands. VOA's Laritza Hoke reports a growing number of voters say they're dissatisfied with many of the candidates running for president.
Millions of Americans on opposite sides of the political spectrum have expressed discontent with politics as usual. And they seem to think that few of the latest crop of presidential hopefuls can offer anything more than that. Real estate mogul Donald Trump has used people's discontent to his advantage.
There's a tremendous movement going on. And it's not about me, it's what I'm saying, it's the message.
Some political analysts have ridiculed Trump's hopes of becoming the Republican Party's nominee because of his tactless remarks and brash manner, as well as his lack of a clear political program. But opinion polls show him far ahead of the other candidates in the race for the Republican presidential nomination. Zlatica Hope, VOA News, Washington.
Worries about slowing economic growth in China, rising political uncertainty in Greece, and concerns about plans to raise U.S. interest rates shook investors on Friday. Some financial experts believe a hike in the U.S. interest rates is looking more likely, and it caused a sell-off.
Well, I think the last couple of days, people have started to lose confidence that our economy is strong enough to withstand a hike in interest rates. We've had concerns about the direction of oil prices. Now we're worried that China's growth is slowing. Also, U.S. corporate profits appear to be anemic. And now the Fed sounds as if they're getting cold feet. So if everybody around you is starting to get scared, it's a little hard for you not to follow suit.
And that's Sam Stovall at S&P Capital. I'm Marty Johnson in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga. Peter Kilote has the day off.
We are leaking money in this country at a pace that is just unbelievable. And the president has to stem that leakage first before even doing anything else.
In Nigeria, high-level officials continue to resign or be fired in the wake of the new president's push against corruption.
What is clear is that the summits have become an old boys' club where the leaders protect each other and look out for each other's interests and not improve the rights of the citizens of SADC.
Address human rights issues, NGOs tell SADC leaders at a regional meet.
There are a very large number of Eritreans fleeing across the Mediterranean, particularly relative to Eritrea's size. Eritrea has a population of about 6.5 million people.
And we look at why so many Eritreans are leaving home at great risk for refuge in Europe. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Human rights groups have condemned leaders of the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, for failing to address regional human rights issues at the summit this week. Sebastian Muhofu has the story from Harare.
According to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, there are serious ongoing cases of human rights abuses in at least six SADC countries: Angola, Lesotho, South Africa, Swaziland, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. In their communique at the end of the summit in Botswana, leaders of the 15-member nation SADC never used the phrase human rights. That led Amnesty and HRW to accuse the SADC of not taking the allegations seriously. Here is Dewama Vinga, a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch.
What is clear is that the summits have become an old boys' club where the leaders protect each other and look out for each other's interests and not improve the rights of the citizens of SADC, for example, in Angola, where the government there is using a number of draconian new laws to suppress journalists. There is no indication as to when their rights will be protected.
The summit marked the end of Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe's one-year term as SADC chairman. Rights groups did not expect much from Mr. Mugabe, whose long record of suppressing opposition and rigging elections has made him a pariah in the West. Debros Muchena, Amnesty International Director for Southern Africa, says he hopes the new chairman, Botswana's President Ian Khama, will listen to the rights group's concerns.
As the leader of SADC, we believe that President Ian Khama must work with his fellow regional leaders to try and find durable solutions to the human rights crisis that is actually now going to even strengthen during his term. If you go to Zimbabwe, allowing the police and other security apparatus to revert to old tactics to intimidate protesters and those that are seeking to speak out. And in particular, we're still getting very concerned with the fact that Itai Dzamara's fate remains unknown.
Dzamara is a pro-democracy activist in Zimbabwe who disappeared in March. In the days before his disappearance, Dzamara had been leading protests calling for President Mugabe to step down. So far, no African government has voiced concern over the missing activist. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
In West Africa, Cameroon and Central African Republic officials are asking truck drivers protesting the killing of 18 of their colleagues in fresh rebel attacks to go back to work. The drivers are condemning persistent harassment from both rebels and Central African Republic government officials. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde.
CAR Transport Minister Arnold Jobaye Abazeni says a food and humanitarian crisis looms as truck drivers have for 2 weeks refused to transport goods from the Douala seaport in Cameroon to Bangui, capital of his landlocked country.
Le gouvernement centrafricain et la MINUSCA vont prendre toutes les mesures nécessaires pour assurer leur sécurité.
He says his government has sent him to assure Cameroon truck drivers that they have agreed with forces of the United Nations Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission in Central African Republic, MINUSCA, to assure their protection. Robin Kili, Cameroon's Minister of Transport, says the drivers are protesting the killing of 18 transport workers within 2 weeks. He says rebels from neighboring CAR have also killed several Cameroonians recently.
There is no driver who can accept to go to Bangui because of that situation, that problem of insecurity. We had a meeting several times, but no major solution. I asked him to insist on the action of MINUSCA to protect any Cameroonian who has decided to go there. If we do it, there will be no problem.
Landlocked CAR depends on supplies exclusively from Cameroon's seaport of Douala, which Libom Lilikeng, Cameroon's customs chief, says is already congested with food and humanitarian assistance destined for troubled CAR.
Nous sommes là pour trouver une solution pour que ces camions déjà chargés puissent aller effectivement.
She says she is at Douala to negotiate with the drivers so that the goods should be taken to Bangui and ease the congestion at the seaport. El Haj Umaru, president of the drivers' union, says they are not only targeted by rebels. He says they are also harassed by CAR officials who accuse them of transporting dangerous goods and weapons used by the rebels.
Nous pouvons malencontreusement, peut-être par inadvertance, porter un objet dangereux sans se rendre compte. Donc,
he says some of them can erroneously or without knowing transport dangerous objects and weapons. He says he has been telling all truck drivers to be vigilant and inform the military should they find out that someone is transporting goods he is not supposed to transport. CAR descended into chaos in March 2013 when Muslim Seleka rebels toppled François Bozizé's government, leading to reprisals from Christians who formed anti-Balaka militias. 90% of imports and exports and all humanitarian aid and supplies for MINUSCA forces transit through Douala. The truck drivers say they will not resume work if their security is not assured and if 5 drivers held hostage or arrested on suspicion of transporting dangerous goods are not released. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The head of Nigeria's Customs Service resigned earlier this week, the latest high-level official to resign or be fired in the wake of the new president's push against corruption. For VOA, Christine reports from Lagos.
Dikko Abdoulaye is the latest government official to leave since President Muhammadu Buhari took office last May with a pledge to clean house in Nigeria's scandal-plagued federal government. Mr. Buhari has similarly shaken up the leadership of the armed forces and the state-owned oil company. Customs is a major revenue generator for Nigeria, notes Don Demowo, a consultant at Africa Practice. Demowo says Mr. Buhari is now looking for someone with a clean reputation to run the agency.
One of the ways he's going to ensure that he's serious about fixing that is to put people in charge that he sees as credible, as transparent, and that will bring that transparency to the agency.
Managing Director of the Lagos-based Center for Public Policy Alternatives, Falarin Badebo Smith, says the departure of the customs head is just the first step to reforming a service that has a reputation for siphoning off funds from travelers and importers.
We are leaking money in this country at a pace that is just unbelievable. And the president has to stem that leakage first before even doing anything else. He cannot do it with the same people who are running the racket.
But there is more to it than that, Badebido Smith said. Allegations of corruption have circled around customs in the past, but the true extent of the misdeeds may not be known until a new leader is hired for the agency.
Everything below the surface of the water there is like 90% of what's going on, while what we see is just the small tip of it.
The president's biggest appointments are yet to come. Cabinet ministers are expected to be announced sometime in September. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The United States just appointed a new special envoy to the Great Lakes region of Africa. Mr. Thomas Perriello succeeds Mr. Russ Feingold. The special envoy's office develops and leads the implementation of U.S. policy on the cross-border security, political, economic, and social issues arising in the Great Lakes region of Africa and the Democratic Republic of Congo. James Swan is the U.S. ambassador in Kinshasa. VOA French to Africa's Idris Fall asked the ambassador for his reaction to the nomination of a new U.S. special envoy for the Great Lakes region.
Well, we're extremely pleased with the appointment of Tom Perriello as the new special envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa. It underscores that the U.S. remains deeply committed to helping the people and governments of this region of the world to find lasting peace.
In DRC, and you are already here, and we know the main issue is the upcoming election, and we don't know yet if Mr. Joseph Kabila going to run for a third mandate.
Congo has a historic opportunity with the presidential elections scheduled for 2016 to achieve the first peaceful transfer of power since independence. We think it's important that this opportunity not be missed. Our government has repeatedly stressed the importance of respecting the Constitution, not just here in Congo, but in other countries in the region, throughout Africa, and indeed around the world. Again, this is a historic opportunity. There is still time to organize these elections credibly, but it's important to move forward quickly to make adjustments that are necessary to achieve the presidential elections by the end of 2016.
If somebody here decides to follow through like it happened in Burundi, what the U.S. will do then?
I think we've been extremely clear throughout this region, in Burundi, in other places where there has been an effort to remain beyond constitutionally acceptable mandates, or where remaining longer has violated other agreements established in those countries. This is dangerous for these countries. It risks greater instability in the future. And our view throughout this region, certainly in Congo, is that it's important to respect the constitutional mandates and to look toward the opportunity for this historic peaceful transfer of power at the end of 2016.
Talking about instability, the East, you have the FDLR rebels, you have the IDF Nalu, and people had been talking about insecurity in the east of DRC. What can be done to stop those violence?
A great deal is already being done, of course. Regrettably, this is a problem that has endured since the mid-1990s. But there are many actions already being undertaken in the context of the Peace, Security, and Cooperation Framework that was signed in Addis Ababa in 2013. There's a very active diplomatic effort involving the special envoys, not just of our own government, but of the United Nations, of the African Union, and others. And, of course, there's a robust peacekeeping operation here in the Democratic Republic of Congo under MONUSCO, the UN Stabilization Mission for the Congo. We think it's important to capitalize on these opportunities and specifically to reinforce cooperation between MONUSCO and the Congolese military in terms of taking action militarily against the armed groups that remain in eastern Congo.
The cooperation between MONUSCO and the army of DRC, apparently it does not work very well often, especially in the north around the Beni region.
Well, it's crucially important that this cooperation resume actively between MONUSCO and the Congolese military. I think the authorities, as well as the UN authorities, of course, need to keep in mind that Congolese citizens are suffering as a consequence of these continued military actions. Finding a way to resume cooperation between MONUSCO and the Congolese military could be extremely helpful in bringing an end to these armed groups that have bedeviled eastern Congo for some 20 years, if not longer.
That was James Swan, the U.S. ambassador to the Democratic Republic of Congo. He spoke with VOA French to Africa's Idris Faure. The number of migrants sailing the Mediterranean has continued to rise in the first 7 months of 2015. The largest migration is Syrians who are escaping Bashar al-Assad and Islamist extremists, but the small African state of Eritrea ranks number two, higher numbers than from Ethiopia, Somalia, or even Sudan. Some Eritreans pay smugglers as much as $3,000 and risk their lives passing through dangerous African neighborhoods to reach the European promised land. In this first part of five-part reports on the Eritrean refugees, VOA's David Arnold talked to a migration expert and an African scholar about why so many Eritreans leave home.
Since Eritrea achieved independence in 1991, President Isaias Afwerki's unchallenged 24-year rule has not produced the achievements envisioned when rebels in sandals won a 30-year guerrilla war and re-entered the capital, Asmara. That's also the view of a few outsiders who've managed to follow independent Eritrea's recent history. Bronwyn Brutland is the deputy director of the Atlantic Council's Africa Center in Washington, D.C., and she is an observer of Eritrea's post-independence struggles.
There are a very large number of Eritreans fleeing across the Mediterranean, particularly relative to Eritrea's size. Eritrea has a population of about 6.5 million people. And last year, it's believed that there were at least 45,000 refugees that fled. And that was a significant increase over previous years. The amount of refugees appears to have tripled in the last year or so, well, since the beginning of 2014.
The European Union is conflicted over the massive migrant flows from Syria and some African countries. The 28 member states of the EU debate whether Eritreans in particular are coming because they are poor or because they are repressed. Leonard Doyle of the International Office for Migration says it really doesn't matter because migration is a natural global phenomenon of people trying to better themselves. But he says Eritrea surely qualifies on economic grounds.
Well, the economy is poor. It's been relatively easy to get into Europe. As that is the case, you know, it would be in the self-interest of any family for their young people to go off to Europe and make the fortune. Unfortunately, it's not really the best way to do things because they can be robbed, they can be beaten up, they can, you know, lose their life along the way. And if they get to Europe, they're unlikely. Well, even if they get political asylum, without skills, they're not necessarily going to be in a position to contribute.
One indicator of the unusual nature of Eritrea's migration is the high number of children who escape from the country. Many believe Eritrea's children are escaping their government's national service, a kind of forced labor.
Well, about 34,000 arrived by sea to Italy alone last year, including nearly 5,000 unaccompanied minors.
Some say Eritrea's estimated 45,000 active-duty military and 250,000 reservists are said to constitute one of the largest armies in Africa, with probably the highest ratio of conscripted citizens. The force is based on mandatory national service for all able-bodied men and women. It was inspired by a long and costly war with neighboring Ethiopia over a border debate that is still unsettled. Critics say Eritrea soldiers have to serve for as many as 10 years, maintaining national security, building roads, and some say working for foreign mining companies. Brutton says national service is a major factor in the migration patterns.
The reasons that people are fleeing, I think, are a little unclear. On the one hand, historically, Eritrea has had a national conscription program, which is a period of national service that in theory was supposed to last for 18 months, but in practice has often been indefinite. The conditions of the service have been very unpleasant. People are paid very small amounts of money. There have been allegations of brutality, torture, sexual abuse. There have been allegations that people who are critical of members of the government, for example, can be arrested and detained indefinitely without due process of law.
Eritrea appears near the bottom of most country-by-country rankings on various indices. Number 181 for human development, 155th for democracy, 189th for ease of doing business, 174th for economic freedom. For the last 8 years, a survey by World Press Freedom ranks Eritrea last. In early June, the UN Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in Eritrea reported possible crimes against humanity in the arbitrary arrest of journalists. Doyle just looks at the numbers and counts Eritreans leaving.
I think it's changing, but heretofore, if anyone fled Eritrea without doing their military service, they were kind of on the wrong side of the law. So there was a tendency to automatically give people from Eritrea refugee status. But that seems to be changing due to changes within Eritrea itself. It's not so clear anymore. But nonetheless, one of the country's big exports is its people, so they keep heading to Europe.
During Bruton's visit to Eritrea, she was told by many government officials and by Mr. Isaias himself that Eritrea is opening its doors and it is demobilizing some of its national service forces. This is David Arnold at VOA in Washington.
Zimbabweans, being the soccer lovers that they are, have been eagerly waiting for the game between the Mighty Warriors and the Ivory Coast, but much to their chagrin, the Sunday 2016 Rio Olympic Preliminary Competition Africa Zone, a third round second leg match, seems to be hanging by a thread as premiership action continues. Reporter Mike Cariati gives us the story.
By this afternoon, the elephants had not yet arrived in Harare, raising questions whether they were coming at all. The elephants had also not informed the Zimbabwe Football Association on whether they would fulfill the fixture as a guessing game on their arrival continues. The Mighty Warriors failed to fulfill their own side of the bargain, but FIFA ordered the second leg to be played after the elephants had also failed to come to Harare for the second leg. There seems to be a breakdown of communication between the two footballing authorities, throwing the two nations' 2016 Rio Olympic Preliminary Competition Africa Zone third round second leg match in doubt. Zimbabwe Women's Football Administrator Teresa Maguraushe yesterday told the media that despite having written to the Ivory Coast Football Association twice a day every day, requesting their itinerary, they had not received any response. However, Castle Lager Premier Soccer League action continues to swing and rolls into week 20. The week 20 showdown provides yet another test of character for under fire former Warriors coach Sande Chizambwa. Yes, struggling ZPC Kariba are on the road to On Fire FC Platinum, who are unbeaten in 11 matches. Noben Mapeza's side are now in fourth position with 34 points from 19 games, 1 point behind joint second place Triangle and Dynamos. On the other hand, ZPC Kariba are in 12th position, just one slot above the relegation zone, and have not won a league match in 8 games since Chizambwa took over. However, Chizambwa does not agree with the much-held view that Castle Lager Premier action is proving too much for him.
I don't think things have been difficult for me in the Premier League. We still have to soldier on, fight until the end of the season, and we'll see what will happen.
Dynamos, too, are on the road to Blawayo for a game against Cholocho Pirates. After their 2-0 away win at Gibo Stadium against Triangle, coach Tondera Indiraya fancies his team's chances against the new boys who are struggling to survive.
We are Dynamos. We've got to be very strong if we want to stay with the top teams there at the top. It's another tough encounter, but I think my guys will fight very hard and perhaps we can get a result there.
Islanders lost out 2-0 to FC Platinum at home yesterday, but coach Bongani Mafu says it is not back to the drawing board, but to the field when his team travelled to Gweru to face Wawa at Ascot.
We don't have a choice. We have to go and dust up and pick it up, go back to the field and work.
Top of the table, Chicken Inn are favoured for maximum points at home to Wange. The other matches are as follows. Harare City versus Buffaloes, Flame Lily versus Chapungu, Capes United versus Dongo and Aumine are at home to Triangle. Reporting for Studio 7 in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come on the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Then we'll have a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Yes, and now it's time for our Saturday Music Spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa. Here we go.
My brain, yo, beautiful lady, yo, that can Africa lady, yo.
Aye.
I sing in the song for Panya,
aye.
And I dance in the dance for Panya, oh. I would do anything for Panya.
Aye.
late. When she come around, she a heavyweight. She a dance, she a move, immediate. Baby, yeah, I am. Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name? I request for my baby girl. Banya, scatter the fluff for me. And I thank you the Lord for Panya. Too much love I have for you.
Abby?
Hey. Aya, what is my baby name? Aya, what is your baby name?
Oh yes, yeah.
Thank you, know. Me and broke it there, so.
Your favorite boy, Techno, on the beat.
Say bad man there, so. Lick up! I stupid.
Already wearing the crown and don't can pull me down. Fish no get fed up. Love we a get no get wet up. Kaki no so leather. Fish naga fed the love we get naga wed. Oh na 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 na. Nega dano weo, deja sabora de la vazada. Nada, baby picture me and you. What I know de paso, I can't live a moment without you. That one day I do. It journey is not easy, but I know so impossible. For me, for plano. Only you. Oh yeah. Take bullet for you, me, I know they afraid you.
Tell me what, tell me what.
Talk to the news and nobody
hate you.
Tell only one you. Say me too. A beautiful girl like you need man like me. I'm always gonna make you that feel alright. Like me, a beautiful girl like you need man like me. I'm always gonna make you that feel alright. Like me, because you know, Toledo fish no get better. The love way I get no get wetter, no get wetter. So, you know, Toledo fish no get better. The love way I get no get wetter, no get wetter. Yeah. Baby girl, you're my one and only. Yeah. And anything that you want, just follow with me, no way. Yeah. Say I'm your man, your salon bubble, no way, yeah. Say mama, don't beat me, say for you sake, I'm ready for dying. Take bullets for you, me, I know they afraid you.
Tell you what, tell you what.
Talk to the news and nobody hate you.
Tell you what, tell you what.
Tell only one you.
Tell you what,
tell you what. Say me too,
you.
Tell you what, tell you what. A beautiful girl like you, man. Need man like me, I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Man like me, a beautiful girl like you. Need man like me, I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Man like me, because you know to let her. Fish no get better, in love way I get no get wetter. No get wetter. So, you know to let her. Fish no get better. The love way I get no go weather, no go weather. Baby, you know me, I'm your man, I can be your better man. Baby, you know me, oh. Baby, you know me, your man, I can be a better man. Baby, you know me, no. If you don't want me, I don't understand, but take my life away, cause you're the one, my only hope. Baby, you're the one and all. Nothing can separate me from you, no. Oh, baby, yeah.
Yes, that was our sad news spot, that wonderful selection by Odette Frazier. Well, I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. Here is Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It is always a pleasure for me to take time to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa. At the same time, I pay close attention to African opinions on an attitude towards the United States. This week, I believe the whole question of America's contribution to health issues in Africa demands greater attention again. During this analysis, it is important to identify how U.S. African relations have made changes in many parts of Africa since independence. Anyone who is interested in this field of research can devote a great deal of time in listing the number of African graduates in medicine and other scientific topics across the United States. If you go back to the history of Africans who came to the United States to study scientific and technological knowledge to bring about changes in their country, you can see how the numbers were very small at the beginning of the 20th century, and how today we have a larger number of Africans who came to the United States. One can divide that number into two or three groups. If you look at the political leadership in Africa, you see how many of them who came from 1900 to the year 2000. And if you look at those who were trained in the United States in the field of political studies, you have an outstanding number of people who can be identified with regard to America and African political developments. But one could very well talk about America and African scientific development in the field of medicine and health. When we talk about these personalities in the political field, of course, Nnamdi Azikiwe, Kwame Nkrumah are always identified as leading lights who came to study here. But there were others who came from East Africa. And today, when we talk about the legacies of President Obama, we identify his father among those who came here and they studied the social sciences, went back home and became economists, political scientists, public administrators, accountants, and others. But you can also talk about those who are medical personalities who contributed to the development of Africa. Someone who is not always mentioned was Hosting Banda of Malawi. So when we talk about the young people who came here over the last 100 years from Africa, there are a lot of people who are not remembered, but they are very much part of the Africans who came to America and studied medicine and went back home. There are Liberians, Sierra Leoneans, Gambians, people from the Francophone countries who came particularly after independence. But before independence, people like Hastings Kamanda of Malawi, who deserves to be remembered because he was a doctor who came, and he belonged to a generation of African doctors who studied in the United States. In his particular case, his biography does not only deal with America's contribution in medicine, but he was one of the very few Africans who studied medicine and was also politically engaged in African history. So, Hastings Kamuzu Banda belonged to those people who has both political and medical links to America. So when young Africans in the universities in Africa look at African doctors who came out of America during this particular period, Banda will be identified. And interestingly, much as we celebrate Kwame Nkrumah and Nnamdi Azikiwe and a whole number of people who came out of East Africa, Central Africa, there were Congolese who came after the time of Lumumba, there are many African political scientists and others who are very much linked to this narrative. And when we look at those Africans who are doctors, Hastings Kamuzu Banda is the one who is both political and medical. And his story could be elaborated. I could talk a longer time, because when you look at Banda, you can see the Banda experience with regard to America's contribution to Africa. There are a lot of young people who came out of East Africa, South Africa, Central Africa, North Africa, and West Africa. So when you conclude this narrative, one can say that U.S. relations with Africa is not only in the field of social science. And the late Ali Mazrui, when he was talking about Greece in African political thought, talk about how people like Kwame Nkrumah and many other Africans who were educated in America carry with them many of the legacies and contributions from America to Africa. So most of our experts who know medicine in Africa and can look at the contribution of America in African medicine, you can see how you can come up with a really elaborate study of medicine, America, and the African experience. And this is a topic that can be the debate among those who are blogging and writing about America and Africa in medical development. And that debate is today.
Thank you, Dr. Suleiman Yang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline Africa team, we thank you for joining us tonight. See you tomorrow, Sunday. Have a good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To predict the future success of a nation, all you need to do is look at how it treats its women, said President Barack Obama recently during a speech before the African Union. Nobody would put out a football team and then just play half the team. You'd lose, said President Obama. The same is true when it comes to getting everybody an education. You can't leave half the team off, our young women.
When girls cannot go to school and grow up not knowing how to read or write, that denies the world future women engineers, future women doctors, future women business owners, future women presidents. That sets us all back. That's a bad tradition, not providing our girls the same education as our sons.
That is why earlier this year, President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama launched the Let Girls Learn initiative. Through this program, a number of United States government agencies and non-governmental organizations, including the Department of State, U.S. Agency for International Development, PEPFAR, the Peace Corps, and the Millennium Challenge Corporation, work together to address some of the many challenges preventing adolescent girls from attending and completing school and receiving high-quality education. So, for example, in northern Nigeria, children displaced by conflict, especially adolescent girls, can continue their education at the newly developed learning centers. In Zimbabwe, through the Girls Empowerment Movement, Let Girls Learn helps establish clubs in schools that encourage girls to be educated and empowered decision makers. And in Kenya, the Global Give Back Circle helps disadvantaged girls pursue their education from upper secondary to university and gain skills that help them secure jobs. Let girls learn so they grow up healthy and they grow up strong. That will be good for families, and they will raise smart, healthy children, and that will be good for every one of your nations, said President Obama. Let's lift up the next generation of women leaders who can help fight injustice and forge peace and start new businesses and create. We'll all be better off when women have equal futures.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.